Good evening, it's Sunday, April 18th, 2021. As attorneys in Derek Chauvin's case prepare to make their closing arguments on Monday, protests continue across the country over the police killings of Dante Wright, Adam Toledo, and others.
Our community of people and the allies have to do how they feel necessary to ensure that we're being heard and saying what is taking place is definitely not right.
Advocates and educators involved with sexual assault advocacy, response, and education pivot their work for a second Sexual Assault Awareness Month in pandemic times.
One of the steps that we decided to do was to implement a chat line.
As Wisconsin's mask mandate was once again overturned at the end of March, many students are now showing up in classrooms unmasked, making some teachers feel uneasy.
We've taken a major world health issue and we've turned it into political gunfire. And I just don't think that we should do that. I think people's safety and the science and the data are the thing that should be driving and should have driven our decisions.
And while April is normally a celebratory month for six, it's a somber time this year as they mourn the loss of community members from the mass shooting in Indianapolis and continue fighting for their rights in the ongoing farmer protests in India.
Our entire community is completely saddened by the loss of both our fellow six and their colleagues. It's not just about, you know, the sick lives that were lost, also the other four that were lost as well.
I'm Sharon Sabota, and this is the KPFA Weekend Evening News. As Sikhs in India are partaking in one of the world's largest farmer protests, the community in the United States is mourning the loss of four Sikh FedEx warehouse employees and four of their other colleagues who died at the hands of a 19-year-old gunman on Thursday. The gunman's own mother had turned him in to police last year with concerns about his mental wellness. After a brief mental health hold last April, he was released. And last Thursday, he returned to his place of former employment and opened fire, killing a total of eight people, ranging in age from 19 to 70. Inderpreet Kaur is with the Sikh Coalition.
Our entire community is completely saddened by the loss of both our fellow Sikhs and their colleagues. It's not just about, you know, the Sikh lives that were lost, also the other four that were lost as well. And, you know, we're mourning them as well as all of Indianapolis is mourning this senseless tragedy altogether. And we're making sure that we're keeping those that are injured in our thoughts and prayers and hoping for a very speedy recovery. And also hoping that, you know, justice will be served as the investigation goes on.
In 2012, I was at a gurdwara covering the aftermath of the Wisconsin shooting that left a total of seven people dead, four were injured. Thousands of people were traumatized though. And here we are, almost a decade later. And sometimes it seems like we make a little progress and then something like this happens. What are you kind of bringing from that bigger picture and this notion that sometimes we make progress and sometimes we make big steps backwards?
I will say, just to reemphasize that the trauma continues to grow, unfortunately. It feels as if just when the community begins to heal, all of a sudden there is something else that we need to be worried about, something else that we need to be fighting for. And it gets very tiring. You know, a lot of the people I do know in our community and in other communities as well, we are very tired of having to be victims of these violent crimes. And so, you know, to answer your question, I really hope that this is a, you know, all of these events that have been taking place are conversation starters. We need to begin having a conversation on how we can put an end to these senseless crimes that are going on, and how can we end this cycle of trauma.
In the Sikh tradition, Kaur says April is significant, but this year's farmers are fighting for their survival in India, and the community is now mourning the aftermath of yet another mass shooting. It's not quite as happy of a time as usual.
The month of April is actually a very auspicious month for us, just because one of our main holidays called Vaisakhi, it's when, you know, the Sikh religion was founded in 1699. It's our anniversary, our birth anniversary. And so, you know, April is also culturally a very significant time for Punjabis or for farmers, because it's the month of harvest. That's when a lot of these farmers are harvesting their crops, getting ready for a new season. And so, you know, Vaisakhi doesn't look the same this year. Our April does not look the same this year. Back home, we have a farmers' protest that is going on. And of course, around the world, we're unable to celebrate as we usually do because of the pandemic. And third, now we have these mass shootings that are going on in the United States, which are, you know, absolutely heartbreaking, not just for our community again, but for other communities as well. And I will say that the best thing that we can do right now, moving forward, is making sure that we're having a conversation about the violence that is going on in this country, you know, and including other communities in this as well. Making sure that this space is as inclusive as possible so we can protect everyone.
That's Inderpreet Kaur with the Sikh Coalition. Attorneys in Derek Chauvin's trial are set to give their closing arguments on Monday. Chauvin is charged with the killing of George Floyd on May 20th of last year by kneeling on his neck for more than 9 minutes. A week ago today, just 10 miles away from where Chauvin's trial is taking place, 20-year-old Dante Wright was killed by Brooklyn Center police officer Kim Potter after being pulled over because of an air freshener hanging in his rearview mirror. In body cam footage, Potter can be heard repeatedly saying, "Taser," before saying she shot him. Potter is now facing second-degree manslaughter charges. Meanwhile, video footage of 13-year-old Adam Toledo, who was shot by police in Chicago on March 29th, has been released, sparking national outrage and protests across the country. I spoke with Wanda Johnson, the mother of Oscar Grant, who was killed in 2009, about the continuing epidemic of police killings across the country.
I've been thinking and looking at some of these incidents of what's going on with our people. And many of the times you will see the victim trying to de-escalate the situation, and the officers are escalating the situation. Instead of the officers trying to calm it down, they're more hyphy is what the youth would say, or they're more amped up than the person who they're arresting. And so we really have to look at that and make a decision. Are we hiring the right people for the right jobs? And obviously we're not doing that.
Johnson, who lost her own son, Oscar Grant, when BART police officer Johannes Meserle claimed he mistook his gun for his taser, says she can see clear parallels in Kim Potter's fatal mistake that took the life of Dante Wright.
The police officer, she was having her adrenaline run. And I don't know if it was because she was in the midst of training, but she nevertheless, in the middle of her training, she shot a shot that's not reversible. This man is no longer here. And she's going to and is being charged with second-degree manslaughter.
There's other cases that exemplify that police do have the ability to use restraint. And it's interesting that the restraint is used for people like Kyle Rittenhouse. He walked past police. He drove home, and he's not behind bars right now. Mm-hmm. That's somebody, mm-hmm. You know, people who've been involved in mass shootings in some cases, particularly when they've happened to be white. Those examples show that restraint is used, but somebody's using discretion about when they use restraint.
Absolutely. And that goes back to the history of policing. In my opinion, it goes back to how the police inception began. And the police inception began was to basically control the generation of African-American people by assuring if they ran away, they would go get them, they would whoop them and beat them and send them back to their slave master or put them in jail. And even at times, they would work to end up killing them. And so all that's a form of control. That control is still going on today. And so we really have to look at it, because when you look at the control, only a certain group of people is manifested, and that control is being enforced toward the group of African-American people versus when you're dealing with the situation with the Caucasian person.
Regarding Derek Chauvin, Johnson says she's cautiously optimistic that he will be held accountable and found guilty for the death of George Floyd.
I'm hopeful that he will be held accountable in the law. I also know it takes one juror to get a hung jury. And we never know who's on the jury pool, who was picked. When we think about it, we knew from the very beginning that this man was guilty of murder. And our society tried to downplay that to say, well, he was using drugs. Well, he had a heart attack. Well, he inhaled the carbon monoxide. Our judicial system would try to shift the blame from the officer and put it on him, on the victim who's deceased. And so my prayer is that the officer is found guilty. Even though that's not really enough, what would be enough is for George Floyd to be still here and his life not taken. But because it is, it has to be another catalyst to work with for change in our society, that officers can no longer put their knee on the individual's neck like they're doing and just hold it there for that excessive amount of time, like George Floyd, even like my son Oscar, and so many others.
And Johnson says, even if the officers that were with Chauvin didn't kneel on Floyd's neck, she believes they should be held equally accountable for not intervening.
I think that the officers with him had a judicial responsibility to get their partner and say, let's handle this a different way. I also believe that because they did not do that, that they are just as guilty as he is, and that they should be held accountable as well.
Last summer, I was sure when we were having this conversation that change was about to happen. How hopeful are you today about change?
Well, we have to start all over again and work on getting some of these laws changed. Of course, we know that there'll be protests probably throughout the country, and millions of dollars that will end up having to be spent to rebuild communities. But, you know, the riots are a voice of the unheard. And if this is a way to be heard, then our community of people and the allies have to do how they feel necessary to ensure that we're being heard and saying what is taking place is definitely not right.
That's Wanda Johnson, the mother of the late Oscar Grant and the executive director of the Oscar Grant Foundation. You're listening to the Weekend Evening News on KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, K248BR 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. I'm Sharon Sabota. April is National Sexual Assault Awareness Month. Statistics show that someone is sexually assaulted every 73 seconds in the United States. Cynthia Peterson is the director of Contra Costa County's Community Violence Solutions Program. Peterson says her staff have had to pivot on their models of support, advocacy, outreach, and education during pandemic times.
One of the steps that we decided to do was to implement a chat line, and we're hoping to get the word out to young people so they can contact us via a chat line if they don't want to actually call the hotline. It seemed like the younger folks are more likely to send you a text versus to pick up the phone and call. So we're continuing to look at ways to reach youth, you know, as much as possible, like I said earlier, through, you know, social media. Most of them have phones, and if we can get our message out and information out about the resources available, hopefully we can reach some of those folks.
While Peterson says the number of sexual assault reports has gone down during the pandemic, it doesn't necessarily mean that sexual assaults have gone down.
At the beginning of the pandemic, we saw a decrease in activity on our crisis line, as well as the need for folks to go to the hospital and obtain the exam for the collection of the forensic evidence. You know, you could go two ways with that. were people scared to report and did not report, or because of the lack of mobility of people, you know, everything was shut down, people were in their homes, did they not engage in social activities that could possibly lead to sexual violence? The third concern or question that I had during this time is, what about the children, you know, that were at home and possibly in an abusive situation? The resources for them to report to someone outside of their homes has been limited if they're not able to go to school or engage with other folks in the community, a safe person that they could possibly tell something was happening to them, or someone in any of those professions identifying the need that something may be happening to a child or a young person.
Well, some 1 in 5 women are victims of sexual assault. Only a fraction of a percentage of perpetrators, or about 5 out of 1,000, will be sentenced to prison. Advocates say this is in part due to the victim-blaming culture we live in. Again, Cynthia Peterson.
Well, I think that it all goes back to who the victims are. For sexual violence, it's all about the rape culture. Things like she asked for, how was she dressed, or what was she wearing? She should not have, you know, possibly been at the party, or, you know, any of those type of things that makes the victim look like she deserved what was happening to her.
Just as George Floyd's past, medical history, and struggles with addiction have been presented by the defense attorney of Derek Chauvin as justification for Chauvin's actions that ended Floyd's life, victims of sexual assault often experience similar scrutiny, causing many to remain silent.
When you look at, you know, all of this in a way of who we are working with, and as you were saying about the parallel between what's going on in our society now, we're looking at folks that possibly have been oppressed and how that comes out and is played out in our society. So there is a parallel between a lot of this. It's so complex, you know, and I think when we get past the feeling that there has to be somebody that's being oppressed in our society and accepting everyone for who they are and where they are, we can move past a lot of this, hopefully.
Even though the work related to supporting victims of sexual assault and human trafficking is taxing, Peterson says what has kept her working in this field for decades is the simple fact that the work is not done.
There's a need for our society to change. There's a need for victims of any type of violent crime, sexual assault, human trafficking, stalking, harassment, to have an ally in the space. There's a need for women of color, you know, to stand up. There's a need for us to support all folks, you know, LGBTQ, anyone who has been, unfortunately, a victim of a violent crime. There's a need for multiple voices to be at the table to change policy and our response to the violent crime. What keeps me going is there's still a need, and I can be a voice at multiple tables discussing multiple issues around this. So that's what I strive for on a daily basis.
That was Cynthia Peterson, the Executive Director of Community Violence Solutions in Contra Costa County. The state of Wisconsin ended the mask mandate put in place by Governor Tony Evers on March 31st. Now, counties and school districts have shifted their language from a mask mandate to a mask recommendation. With many schools operating at nearly full capacity, many students are now opting out of wearing masks in the classroom. This has some educators feeling particularly vulnerable. Paul Meninsky is an alternative education and special needs instructor in Mosinee, Wisconsin. Meninsky reflected on the shift from in-person to virtual instruction last spring, followed by an abrupt transition back to in-person instruction in fall.
What I saw from the population I deal with, the students, those are the individuals that really require a lot of attention and learn in a lot of different ways and have a lot of special needs. They were devastated. It was difficult for kids to deal, first of all, with the pandemic without a support mechanism. It was difficult for them to use the technology to try to learn. And it was probably the hardest thing I've done in 33 years of teaching. It was the first time I've really taught virtually. It really was a struggle to try to connect with kids. And I would tell you that it takes a special, unique individual to learn virtually. And definitely the needs of my students suffered. It took us a while to kind of try to get back into the in-person teaching, which I feel for a lot of students was the most beneficial. And so we struggled.
He also talked about the politics of masks, social distancing, and COVID protocols in Wisconsin.
According to our state constitution, the governor is able to issue an emergency order for 60 days. And the Supreme Court ruled that, yes, the governor can issue for 60 days, and then the legislators have to pass an order, a law. There's been a lot of debate about that in Wisconsin. And so the governor's order was basically struck down. And now for about the last 30 days, we've been under a no mask mandate.
Several times in Wisconsin, the Tavern Association has been the ones who got the lawsuits in motion to get the mask mandate, you know, taken away. Talk about that. Why has the Tavern Association been so powerful in Wisconsin?
Well, number one, Wisconsin consumes more alcohol than anybody per capita in the world, probably. We have breweries. The Tavern League is a very powerful institution in Wisconsin. They have a lot of money. In my town, I think there's 7 taverns in a small town. There's only 2 stoplights and about 7 taverns. Part of that mandate was that the governor could not regulate capacity at restaurants and taverns, which if you study the data, we knew that the spread really was big in restaurants and taverns because people gather, they usually are drinking, eating, and they take their mask off. And so that was the reason the governor said, look, you're only going 25% capacity. And that's gone now. Now you're at full capacity. You can have an outdoor concert, indoor concert. You can have all that. So I'm concerned, and it hasn't happened yet. I'm concerned that in the next few weeks, we might see a surge in Wisconsin.
Meninsky estimates that about half of his students are wearing masks at the high school he works at.
I would say we probably have 50% of our students wearing masks, maybe a little bit less. But that's been a bigger issue in America. You know, you've got a group of people that feel that the pandemic really isn't a pandemic. And you've got a group of people that feel it's a very serious matter. I personally feel it's a very serious matter. I have a person that wears the mask and I believe in the mask. I've been vaccinated. So for me, it was different. But, you know, this has been a lesson a little bit in what we preach about difference of opinions and understanding. And also, telling kids and students and adults, follow the science, follow the data, know the facts rather than feelings and make your voice heard that way.
Let's just say half of the students are wearing a mask. That means half of them are not wearing a mask. How does that make you feel as an educator? And how much do you feel like the state of Wisconsin has your back as an educator?
Even when we started this in-person thing, this was a very difficult situation for me because I wanted to be with my students. But at the same time, I also wanted to understand that this was a major risk. And we didn't do the cohorts what most people are doing. Some teachers retired. They retired saying, I am not going to put myself through this. I have underlying health conditions or whatever. So this was a really individually difficult decision for everybody. Now, as you well know, we really don't have unions, teacher unions in the state of Wisconsin. We do, but they're really powerless after Act 10 in 2010. So much like some other places where they could bargain as a collective unit, we are not able to do that. So it was either teach or you don't have a job.
When students started trickling into your classroom without masks, how does that make you feel and operate as an instructor?
I often had talks with my students about why I was wearing a mask and why I felt it was important. And I basically tried to educate them through my point of view about what I was doing. I'm really wearing the mask for other people. Obviously, it protects me also, but I'm doing it for other people in case I ever would get the, you know, COVID. I would not spread it to anybody else, or at least the possibility of spreading it would be reduced. And so I said, I'm wearing the mask for you. And so I think a lot of students understood that.
Did that sway your students?
I have some students in my classroom that do not wear a mask. The hard part is accepting those differences. I'm trying to work around them. It's not an easy environment. You get some students that have had tension with each other because somebody does have an underlying condition and they made a choice to come to school and somebody else isn't wearing a mask. And so you have student-student tension, teacher-student tension. It has not been the greatest of years. And
for our listeners, can you give us a picture of the demographics of the area where you're at in terms of socioeconomically? It's a very working class community, right?
This will sum it up. We have two traffic lights, stop and go lights in our town. So that'll kind of give you an idea. But we're generally rural. We do have some manufacturing industry, but we're more of a blue collar town. A lot of farming community.
I know that Mr. Trump made a few visits to Wisconsin, and it seems that he really tried to capitalize on some of the people that you're describing, like blue collar white Americans, even if his policies might not have really benefited them. And he definitely caused people to question things like the mask. What do you think the draw is?
I'll tell you two things. The President Donald Trump came to our local airport and spoke twice. We even had an anti-mask protest at a place in Mosley, Wisconsin, where there was a COVID outbreak during the anti-mask rally. Part of the issue with the mask is when you have your political leaders and you are not following a policy that is based on science and data, this can cause a major problem. It's the same thing you see in the state of Wisconsin. Our governor has been pro-mask from the day he was elected, from the day this happened. And our Senate and House of Assembly have not. They've had many political issues about this.
Meninsky says he believes it's misguided to treat the pandemic as anything other than a public health issue.
We've taken a major world health issue and we've turned it into political gunfire. And I just don't think that we should do that. I think people's safety and the science and the data are the thing that should be driving and should have driven our decisions. But I think what you get is we had an election. Being reelected is a major thing. Economics. We all know that if the economy isn't strong, you're possibly not going to get elected. I mean, all these things played a factor in some of these decisions, and they really shouldn't have. People's health and safety should have been the number one factor in determining what we did.
That's Paul Meninsky, a high school teacher from Mosinee, Wisconsin. And the weather. In the San Francisco Bay Area, clear and 50 tonight, sunny and 70 tomorrow. In the central San Joaquin Valley, lows in the mid-50s tonight, partly cloudy with highs in the upper 80s tomorrow. That's it for this evening's newscast. Thanks to Rada Keel, who's at the controls, and thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. I'm Sharon Sabota. Good evening.